You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Game by Bomani Jones. Players at the University of Texas made one of the most organized pushes for change that we've seen from college athletes this year. On June 12th, receiver Brennan Eagles and other Longhorns players tweeted their demand that the university rename buildings commemorating segregationists and a Confederate Postmaster General. Remove a statue of the governor who signed the state's first Jim Crow laws, and retire the Eyes of Texas, the school's fight song that's been linked to a 1903 minstrel show. The players said they would not participate in recruiting or donor events without those changes, but they would practice and play. The threat wasn't hollow. One of the unspoken jobs of a college athlete is entertaining boosters, attending their kids' birthday parties and the like. An athletics program is only as good as its athletes, so refusing to participate in attracting talent could have real consequences. That brought the university to the table, and the school has met them in the middle. Buildings will be renamed. Statues of black figures will be erected on campus, and students and visitors will receive a more thorough understanding of many of the university's historical figures. Most important, the school released a plan to increase black recruiting and enrollment, currently around 5%, in a state that's more than 12% black. Think of all the courage and temerity it took for those young men to enumerate their concerns, share them with the world, and stand in their truth. Missouri's football players helped sway a campus movement. Texas's players right now are doing the same. They are fighting for dignity like Oklahoma State's and Iowa's players. But in the larger campus space, not just the locker room, it's a noble use of the platform afforded by the spotlight of sports. But most telling is, in this time of upheaval, when those on the ground have more attention than ever, none of the things those Longhorns ask for were particular to athletes, except asking not to sing a song. For all the power we'd love to say athletes possess, they know what's going too far. Before they even ask for real change, they have to start with something more basic, respect. This brings us back to Bob Orr, who's been having his own existential political reckoning. The NCAA's system of punishment is arcane, but so is everything else surrounding college athletics. Every fight athletes have taken up, each one that seems seismic when it hits the news, is asking for something basic. It's a reminder that the heroes of civil rights in America gave their lives and livelihoods for things the Constitution allowed them to do. The status quo was so backward and indefensible that heaven and earth were moved to allow black people to do what wasn't implied in the Declaration of Independence, but was promised after the Civil War. The fight for many wasn't to win. It wasn't even to get level. It was just to get started. That's what happens when a group has no rights anyone is required to respect. That is where college athletes stand now. Professional sports leagues and their respective unions had protracted negotiations about what playing in 2020 would require. College athletes have no organization to represent or advocate for them. Devin Ramsey says the lack of allies is what he will always remember about his battle for NCAA eligibility in 2010. He had expected help from his school. Ramsey felt let down by his fellow athletes who had accepted illicit payments, but Ramsey himself had not, nor, he insisted, had he done anything else wrong. Since that seemed obvious, he expected the school to have his back. But UNC was sore with shame and vulnerable to punishment, concerned with protecting itself and indifferent to the fate of the players. The school wanted to bring their own investigation to clear their names. "Then my name came up," Ramsey said. "Then I got thrown under the bus. It wasn't even a final draft, and I lose my eligibility." Ramsey says UNC's compliance officer told him to sign something admitting guilt, and doing so would make him eligible immediately. "That was a bold-faced lie," he says now, speaking by phone. "She knew how the NCAA works, so they lied to me about how it was done and served me up. Once that was the case, you know, they didn't feel like I was Carolina family. You're sacrificed for the brand." 9 years later, that officer defends her process, noting every effort was made to ensure fairness, and adding, "I remain confident in the fulfillment of my commitment to serve all student athletes with their best interest as the top priority." Ramsey's saving grace was Orr, who represented him in his fight. "I didn't have any idea of what my options were. Had no one to speak up for me when talking to the athletic director. You're just kind of lost in the system," Ramsey says. "You think they have your best interest at heart, but they don't." But aside from the fact that not everyone can get help from a retired state Supreme Court justice, not every man like Orr, twice a UNC alum, can be trusted. What was really tough about my own situation is everyone's somehow tied to the university, Ramsey said. "It's hard to get an advocate who's on your side, someone without ties to the community or the school." Ramsey was suspended for 8 games that season. The NCAA ultimately deemed his work with the tutor to be run-of-the-mill academic counseling. This good student, at 31, a grown man who now works in finance and started Parati, an education technology business, with his friends, was encouraged by his institution to brand himself a cheater, regardless of truth. Ramsey sees the current pandemic landscape and can't ignore the same thing Arizona defensive back Malik Hausman noticed this summer when his school's president, Robert Robbins, said school wouldn't reopen if cases didn't decline. Hausman, taking part in voluntary workouts, tweeted a simple question: "So why me and my team on campus then?" No one has to answer. It's no one's job to ask for him, and he can't do much more about it than tweet. Mississippi, A Poem in Days by Kisi Makeba Lehman, with opening painting by Diana Ejaita, which shows all the hallmarks of life since COVID-19. Day 1. 22 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump tweets, "We have a perfectly coordinated and fine-tuned plan at the White House for our attack on coronavirus." I hear from Joe Osmondson, writer, friend, and scientist, that I should not attend the Association of Writers programs, a conference I say I am too tired to attend, a conference where I will not be paid for attending. "The government is way behind on this," Joe writes. "Experts in our community are the best we have. I've been talking to a lot of friends working on this, and I trust them a lot." "Should I fly, fam?" I ask him. "It's not us we're doing this for," he texts back. "The risk for you is still low, but it's kind of like, what do we owe our elders and the folks with compromised immune systems?" "Thanks for this," I write back. "I'm going to sit my ass at home and not go to these other events on my schedule." These other events are paid readings I'm supposed to do in Ohio and West Virginia. These events are where I make most of my money. The first event in Ohio is sold out, but I tell myself that I'm sure they'll postpone before the 10th. I assume the same thing about West Virginia. I am lonely. I am afraid. I drive to the casino in Tunica, Mississippi, one of the poorest counties in the United States, and lather my hands in sanitizer. It could all be so much worse, I tell myself, not accounting for how bad I will make it. Day 2. 31 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and after meeting with Republican leaders, Donald Trump says, "It's about 26 deaths within our country, and had we not acted quickly, that number would have been substantially more." These paid events I am booked to attend have yet to be canceled. It took Grandmama, the person who will get most of the money I make for these trips, a year working in the chicken plant to make the kind of money that awaits me for these two events. Grandmama is one of the elders Joe talked about. She is a 90-year-old black woman from Mississippi, and her immune system is severely compromised. She believes she is still alive because of hard work and Jesus Christ. I have my agency tell the folks in Cincinnati that I will not, under any circumstance, be signing books or shaking hands at the event. We all have to be safe. Later that night, I sign books, I shake hands, I hug people, I feel love. I lather my hands in sanitizer. A moneyed man at the event gives me a ticket to see Lauryn Hill, who is also in Cincinnati. I tell organizers of the event that I'd rather go to the Lauryn Hill show than go to dinner. I skip Lauryn Hill. I skip dinner. I congratulate myself on skipping both, on looking out for elders and people like my grandmama with compromised immune systems. It could all be so much worse, I tell myself. Day 3. 38 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump says in his address to the nation, "The virus will not have a chance against us. No nation is more prepared or more resilient than the United States." I am outside of my hotel in Cincinnati, waiting for a car service to drive me to Marshall, West Virginia. When the lanky old white man with large knuckles pulls up, I place my bags in his trunk. I do not shake his hand. Neither he nor I have on a mask or gloves. I am headed to West Virginia to get this money in the back seat of a new black car driven by an old white man. I lather my hands in sanitizer. Barely out of Cincinnati, the driver tells me he is a preacher. We talk about his church, his calling, his time living in the Bronx, his wife's abusive upbringing, all the powerful men he's driven place to place. He stops talking for a bit, and I look at the land we're zooming by. I am a writer. I should be writing about land I've never seen. I lather my hand in sanitizer, open my phone to type a sentence. It could all be so much worse, I write. I get to West Virginia 2 hours before I'm supposed to have dinner with the organizers of tonight's event. Kristen walks me from the hotel around the corner to the restaurant. There is a long table of around 10 folks already sitting down. How y'all doing? I ask, faking a laugh. I guess we're not doing handshakes, huh? I am forever a fat black boy from Jackson, Mississippi. I hate to be trapped in white places where I do not know anyone black. My mama and grandmama rarely sit with their backs to doors. I choose the seat at the end of the table next to a young brother whose hairline makes me remember Mississippi. Under the table, I lather my hands in sanitizer. I'm sitting across from two powerful white people whose rhythms I cannot pick up. I cannot tell when they will laugh, when they will fidget. I cannot tell if they actually laughed or fidgeted. The white woman in front of me does not want to be there. I find out that the university is preparing to suspend in-person classes and begin distance learning. No one is coming to this reading tonight, I tell myself. That's definitely for the better, as long as I can still get my check. I order a Thai cauliflower wrap and fries. There is no way I'm eating that wrap, or the fries. I eat all but one of the fries when the brilliant brother with the familiar hairline offers me some sanitizer. You think we could shake hands now? He asks. Oh, absolutely, I say, and shake the hands of all the incredible students, thanking everyone for wanting to come out in such a scary time. I ask for a to-go box for my wrap and say that I hope to see y'all at the reading. On the way to the reading, I stop back by the hotel because I don't need my backpack smelling like old cauliflower. White people treat black people who smell like old cauliflower like black people. I'm scared. I'm tired. I'm lonely. I need my check. I don't want to be treated like a black person by white people while trying to dodge coronavirus. It's hot in my room. I'm sweating way too much. I take off the shirt beneath my meager hoodie. It's drenched. I place the cauliflower wrap on the counter. I think I have coronavirus. Or I'm just fat. Or I'm just nervous. I think I have coronavirus. I get to the venue. The white woman who greets me walks with a limp. I walk with a limp. She kindly takes me to the green room. A gentle, tall white man knocks on the green room door and pulls out a huge bottle of sanitizer. Your agency told us you needed this. Oh, wow, I say, trying to act like I had no idea. That's weird. Thanks. After the reading, some of the astounding students whom I had dinner with come on stage and ask me to sign their books, take pictures, shake hands. I sign their books, take pictures, shake hands. I walk out to the foyer, sit at a table, and sign more books. After all the books are signed, I walk out and meet the gentle, tall, white man who gave me the sanitizer. He is going to be taking me back to my hotel in his truck. We talk about coronavirus. We talk about Randy Moss. We talk about Jason Williams. We talk about coronavirus. As we get to my hotel, I'm wondering whether I'm supposed to shake his hand, since I'm convinced both of us have coronavirus. The tall, gentle, white man keeps both hands on the steering wheel and tells me bye. Thanks, I say out loud. My room smells like old cauliflower. I take 2 showers, lather my hands in sanitizer, and I try to dream. Day 4. 40 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves is cutting short his European vacation because of Donald Trump's European travel restrictions. At 5 in the morning, another white man picks me up to drive me to the airport. He does not speak. I give him a big tip when he drops me off. He holds the money like I'd hold a boogery Kleenex given to me by a white man driving me to an airport. "Thanks," I say out loud. I'm wearing a black hoodie, a black hat, a black Bane mask, black headphones. Hanging around my neck are 2 dog tags. One, a quote from James Baldwin, says, "The very time I thought I was lost, my dungeon shook and my chains fell off." The other, a quote from Lucille Clifton, says, "They ask me to remember, but they want me to remember their memories, and I keep on remembering mine." I take a selfie on the plane and place it on Instagram with the caption, "Strange times when you have to be on the road to make money to help care for a miraculous 90-year-old woman who you won't be able to touch for 14 days. Kindness, tenderness, generosity, we can do this." 14 days, I tell myself, it could all be so much worse. "The virus will not have a chance against us," Donald Trump says later that afternoon. Day 5. 413 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump will not say, "I am sorry." Governor Tate Reeves decides that the one abortion clinic in Mississippi is not an essential business that should remain open, but gun stores are. I've written around Tate without saying Tate's name for 8 years. In college, my partner, Nizola, and I got into an altercation with 2 fraternities on bid day. Some fraternity members wore Confederate capes, Afro wigs, and others blackened their faces. I've written about how they called us the N-word. I've written about how they called Nizola the N-word B. I've written about that experience and guns. I've written about that experience and bats. I've written about that experience and how my investment in patriarchy diminished Nizola's suffering. I have never written about the heartbreak of seeing the future governor of Mississippi in that group of white boys, proudly representing the Kappa Alpha fraternity and its Confederate commitment to black suffering. I have never admitted that after playing basketball against Tate all through high school, and knowing that he went to a public school called Florence, not a segregation academy like so many other white boys we knew, it hurt my feelings to see Tate doing what white boys who pledged their identities to the Old South ideologies were supposed to do. When I saw Tate in that Confederate cacophony of drunken white boyhood doing what they did, I knew he could one day be governor of Mississippi and president of the United States. That is still the most damning thing I can ever say about a white boy from Mississippi. Day 6. 9,400 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump will not say, "I was wrong." Mama is scared because the nurse we pay to take care of Grandmama will not wear her mask for fear that it could hurt my grandmama's feelings. I am scared because Mama will not stop going to work. She sends me a eulogy she wants me to read if she dies. The eulogy confuses me. There is so much left out. She wants people to know her dream was to be of use to the world, and particularly Mississippi. But the eulogy is more about the places Mama has been than the justice work she's done. I do not argue with Mama. I tell her that if she dies before I die, I will read the eulogy as it is written. It could all be so much worse. I got an email from the writer Cherry Lusai saying that one of those dead 9,400 Americans is my former student, Kimberly Nguyen. Kimberly and I shared a classroom at Vassar College. Long before she was my student, Kimberly would greet me with this raspy offering, "Yo, Kisi." When we finally shared a classroom, I was unable to adequately protect Kimberly from the phantoms haunting most American classrooms. Phantoms need host. Many white hosts need phantoms. These phantoms encouraged Kimberly to write her Cambodian self out of her writing. They disciplined her for not erasing her family's memories of Khmer Rouge. Kimberly accepted her sadness, her fatigue, her anger, and then along with James and Charmaine, she willed herself to write more deeply into the historic imagination of ancestral spirits. I always assumed coronavirus would take my grandmama, my mama, my aunties, my friends, me, possibly in reverse order. I never, ever assumed it would take my students. Day 7. 104,051 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump will not say, "I am sorry." After Darnella Frazier, a 17-year-old black girl from South Minneapolis, courageously films police executing a survivor of coronavirus named George Floyd, and Breonna Taylor, an EMT tasked with aiding those with coronavirus, is shot by police 5 times in her own house, incredibly effective protests begin out in the United States. The week before, savvy young folks longing to breathe and break fill Jackson, Mississippi streets. A lone, white, Jewish teacher in Oxford, Mississippi cuts his hands and places bloody handprints all over the biggest Confederate monument on the campus of Ole Miss. The Jewish Brother spray paints spiritual genocide on all 4 sides of the monument before being arrested. Instead of covering the monument, workers are told to cover spiritual genocide with what looks like swaddling cloth. I help bail the Jewish Brother out. I help bail out folks in Mississippi, in Minneapolis, in Louisville. I go home alone. I'm 45 years, the exact age Grandmama was when I was born. Just like Grandmama, at 45, I live alone in Mississippi. Yet, unlike Grandmama, I have no children, no grandchildren. I own no land, no garden, no property, and I am afraid of walking in my neighborhood under the light of a moon or sun. This should not haunt me, but phantoms move at their own speed. I sit in this house, once the site of a Confederate mansion, alone, afraid to go outside, afraid to let anyone outside see me. I am more successful than I've ever imagined, yet I am terrified of sleeping because my body no longer knows how to dream. I know that people die in their dreams. I am not afraid of death. I am afraid of being killed while dreaming, driving while black, jogging while black, dreaming while black, fighting while black, loving while black. I wonder if movement, mobility, love are the features of black life, the worst of white Americans most despise. Day 8. 108,278 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump will not say, "I am sorry," or "I was wrong." It is my mama's birthday. I planned to be with her today, but I cannot. She is up north. I am down south. It is also Governor Tate Reeves's birthday. I wonder how he celebrates with the phantoms that hover around the Mississippi state flag I assume he keeps somewhere in his house. Day 9. 113,774 Americans are dead from coronavirus. I wonder why so many white folks are contacting me today. Half are asking me if I'm okay. Half are telling me that they are ready to learn. F. I drive by the two massive Confederate monuments in Oxford. Black officers are guarding them both. I want to ask the brothers if they are humiliated guarding monuments that commemorate our destruction. When they start answering or radioing for backup, I want to say, oh, one sec, bruh. Then I want to blast the first verse of F the Police. I imagine the brothers parked in the shadows of the armed monuments, banging a beat on top of their cruisers, and all of us rapping F the Police until backup arrives. When the white officer arrives, I imagine getting all bougie black professor on them, explaining that white Mississippians cling to the Confederacy not because they lost the Civil War, but because they cheated in a rigged battle against black Mississippians. Their monuments are memorials of our suffering at the hands of folk who never had to pay, play, live, or fight fair. But they already know that. Every Mississippian, whether they admit it or not, knows that. What they don't know is that F the Police was one of our memorials, one of our most evocative monuments, and every member of NWA had roots in the South. I wanted to play it so badly as I watched that police precinct in Minneapolis burn, and when Trump sicked his National Guard on peaceful protesters so he could get a photo Beelzebub would be jealous of. I want to bump F the Police right now. The existence of the song is proof that even if we could not bring as much material suffering to white folk as they did to us, we could memorialize and channel the spirits of those beaten and killed by nasty-ass cheaters. Mama's greatest worry is that I will be shot out of the sky by these cheaters. She is right. One day I will not get up off the ground. Mama knows that in my dreams we soar bulletproof, and often we crash. In my actual dreams, I run like Ahmad. I shoot mid-range jumpers like George. I heal like Brianna. I rap every lyric to F the Police in a Monte Carlo packed to the brim with them and Minjon and Tim and Henry and David fiending for new ways to love each other. I fantasize about doing to white folks and their police what they do to us. And more than fantasize, I remember and relish publicly rapping words Grandmama could never whisper outside of her house. But there is a way to commemorate our losses and our wins without humiliating queer folks and subsequently morally debasing those of us who are not queer, those who we seek to humiliate, we eventually seek to destroy. And that first verse of F the Police does not fairly memorialize or commemorate the lives of queer folks. I had to stop rapping to it over 2 decades ago. I had to stop listening to it in 2015. As absurd as it sounds, the only thing harder than giving up F the Police was giving up lying to people I purported to love, giving up disordered eating, and giving up gambling. Queer antagonism, like trans antagonism, like anti-blackness, is an addiction broken only by honest reckoning, consistent practice, and the welcoming of radical spirits. Like most Mississippians, I am an addict. Like most Americans, I am a coward. I wave at the black officers guarding the Confederate monuments. They wave back. Idea victorious, and then you die, churns in the background. And I drive myself home. F, F. Day 10. 125,039 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and Donald Trump has not publicly worn a mask. The tender nurse we pay to take care of my grandmama has contracted coronavirus, and the Mississippi legislature, pressured by young people's power and the threat of losing money, has finally agreed to take down the Mississippi flag. Though it would have been politically devastating, Governor Tate Reeves could have stopped or slowed the flag from coming down. I want to believe Tate did right for Mississippi because he remembers how wrong black Mississippians have been done by white folks in Mississippi. I cannot substantiate my belief. Day 11. 126,929 Americans are dead from coronavirus. While the virus is surging in Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves vetoes a bill passed unanimously by the legislature that grants relief and forgiveness to residents in Jackson who cannot pay their water bill. I tell myself it could all be so much worse. Day 12. 128,761 Americans are dead from coronavirus. And according to civil rights icon Frankie Adams Johnson, it doesn't matter if Governor Reeves or President Trump makes mask mandatory, says I'm sorry, or I was wrong. The awakening, she says, has begun. The Mississippi flag no longer exists, and Ms. Frankie Adams Johnson says that these times are biblical. Growing up in Jackson, Ms. Adams Johnson was one of our civil rights superheroes. She grew up the child of sharecroppers right outside Jackson. Frankie marched with students from Brinkley High School to support protesters doing the lunch counter sit-ins downtown. Before they could get downtown, the high school students were arrested. Since there were too many students to fit in the paddy wagons, the police put the black children in garbage trucks and took them to jail. An officer hit Frankie in her back with one of his rifles, then cocked the rifle and aimed it at her head. Frankie was 17 years old the week Fannie Lou Hamer was nearly beaten to death in Winona, and her youth leader, NAACP Field Secretary Medgar Evers, was assassinated in his Jackson driveway. Not soon after that, Frankie left Mississippi for New York. I lather my hands in sanitizer before asking Frankie what she thinks of the young people who are risking it all for freedom during a pandemic, what the fall of the Mississippi flag means to her, and if it could all be so much worse. That rag sheet coming down won't erase history. But let me tell you something, Kesey. It sure helps release some of the pain I carried. When we sang We Shall Overcome out in front of the Black Masonic Temple, those crackers would be out there with that rag sheet talking about we shall keep the N-words down. Mississippi sent me running for freedom in New York in 1967. My son was born there. 33 years later, New York sent me running back to Mississippi to breathe. The young folks are experiencing what we experienced. They are awakening to the smells of freedom. It's an awakening. Call it what it is. They know this thing is rotten. They see that America, as we know it, is crumbling. You know who the hippies were? They were the master's children who turned on their parents. I don't care who you are. Once you get that awakening, you will risk it all for freedom. The coronavirus is just terrible, but it has a biblicalness to it, you know. It's a rich time for writers to write. It's a rich time for awakenings. It's forced me to sit still and consider my own memories. The young people are working their way to the eye of the storm so we can all be free. They have given me so much joy. I worry, though, about the battle scars, the trauma, the crumbs they will be given. You have to know yourself better than you know your enemy. That is what we didn't do. This is an awakening, but there are prices to be paid for awakening in this country. That's really all I can say. I wipe the sweat from my neck, the tears from my eyes, and I lather my hands in sanitizer. It could all be so much worse. Day 13. 130,646 Americans are dead from coronavirus. Mississippi is surging, and President Donald Trump and Governor Tate Reeves have failed to make masks mandatory or say, "I was wrong. I am sorry." Here's what I want to believe. Tate Reeves and all these white Mississippians who, just like us, immediately smell the difference between a collard and a turnip, who come from sharecroppers, who hear that bended brilliance in the blues, who hate the way Northerners use the South as a convenient shield against their trespasses, who feel the daily grace black folks from the Deep South have offered white folks from the Deep South in the face of unrelenting humiliation, are being played by a devilish, desperate Northerner who has allowed his daddy issues to ruin and eventually run his marriages, business, friendships, soul, and now his nation further into hell. There's a part of these white Southerners, like Tate Reeves, our white cousin by blood and culture, who refuses to heed the spirits of awakening. That is not evil or irrecoverable, but just easily seduced by power, inferiority complexes, and a longing to be accepted by a manipulative maniac who glided into the presidency with the cowardly winds of white American resentment at his back. Here's what I know to be true. Tate Reeves and most of these white Mississippians are no more regionalist or lovers of Mississippi and the Deep South than Donald Trump is a patriot and lover of the United States of America. They are not haunted by phantoms. They are dedicated ghouls, spirit-repellent patriarchs who use each other and a muddled understanding of Jesus Christ to ensure the suffering of the most vulnerable. Abusive power, taste, touches, smells, sounds, and feels really good to gobblers of grace. They are not 19-year-old boys trying to decide between right and wrong. They are grown men who have chosen to model meanness for their posterity. They will torture and humiliate everyone close to them to maintain the power to abuse. They will never, ever say or mean, "I am sorry for making living harder than it needs to be. I am sorry for feeding off your humiliation. I am sorry for never confessing my actual sins to the world. I am sorry that your life means less to me than my ego." They will never say, "I am sorry." They will only remind Americans and Southerners foolish enough to listen that it could all be so much worse. The truth is, were it not for this awakening led by our young people and old spirits, they would be absolutely right. Day 14. 131,870 Americans are dead from coronavirus, and I am turning in my piece to the editors at Vanity Fair. I know there is no incentive, credential, or subsidy for the spirits that guides us. Every dime of the money I make from this assignment will go to help residents of Jackson who cannot pay their water bills. We are awakened, I want to believe. 75 miles from the armed Confederate statue in Oxford, Emmett Till's childish body was destroyed. 70 miles from that armed Confederate statue, Fannie Lou Hamer was nearly beaten to death. 160 miles from that armed Confederate statue, Medgar Evers was murdered as he enters his home. 80 miles from that armed Confederate statue, Martin Luther King was murdered in Memphis. It took way too much black death to get here. I'm wandering around the spiritual consequences of materially progressing at the expense of black death. I want to be courageous. I wonder, though, when courage becomes contagious, when courage is credentialized, subsidized, and incentivized, if it is still courage at all. Today, as I prepare to push send, and I lather my hands in sanitizer, it feels a bit too much like cowardice. Maybe I'll wait to send tomorrow. Maybe I won't send at all. The Lafayette County Board of Supervisors, a group of white men, unanimously vote to keep the armed Confederate monument in the middle of Oxford, the town where I live, teach, and write. Humiliation, agony, and death are what I feel. It could all be so much worse, is what the worst of white folks want us to recite. The worst of white folk will not be persuaded. They can only be beaten. And when they are beaten, they fight more ferociously. They bruise us. They buy us. That is why we are so tired. That is why we are awakened. We are fighting an enemy we've shown exquisite grace. An enemy we've tried to educate, coddle, and outrun. An enemy that never tires of killing itself, just so it can watch us die. Titillation. I lather my hands in sanitizer and Google gun shops in Lafayette County on my phone. I do not believe in guns. I do not believe in prisons. Yet I know I need one if I am to continue living alone in this Mississippi American town. I look at the grizzled cotton fields outside my truck window on Highway 6. I want to ask, where am I? But I know this is not home. If this is home, it is not healthy. I do not want to humiliate. I do not want to be humiliated. I do not want to kill. I do not want to be killed. I want us to be free. I know what I feel. I know what I've felt. I must buy a gun if I continue to live in Oxford, Mississippi. So I cannot continue to live in Oxford, Mississippi. No more. It took way too much black death to get here. And here is where I'd love to live without guns, without prisons, without monuments of humiliation, without the undervalued expected sacrifice of essential workers, without the worst of white folks. Here is where I'd like to tenderly, honestly, radically live and love with you. And here, one day, will be Mississippi. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.